As a child, I was fascinated with the bridge ladies. They showed up regularly at our house, their hair frosted, their nylons shimmery, carrying patent leather pocketbooks with clasps as round as marbles. I loved greeting them at the door, hanging up their coats in our front hall closet, where I often played inside the folds of my mother's mink. I watched as they gathered around the card table, crowded with a twin set of cards, ashtrays, cellophane-wrapped cigarette packs, a scoring pad, and crystal dishes of candy. Eye level to the bridge table, I greedily surveyed the candy and would plan high-speed kamikaze raids to nab some from below my mother's radar. Where my father would let me sit on his lap while he played gin rummy for a hand or two, the bridge ladies erected a square fortress with their backs as they played, communing in their strange language of bids and tricks. As a teenager, I'd make myself scarce when the bridge ladies came over. As far as I was concerned, they were square. They didn't work, didn't seem to get that feminism was taking over the world. Billie Jean King had defeated Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes tennis match. Gloria Steinem had started Ms. Magazine, and Helen Reddy roared. To me, the bridge ladies were conventional, their sphere limited to family, synagogue, and community. Their identities restricted to daughter, mother, and wife, on top of which their idea of fun was an afternoon of playing bridge. Seriously? I was after bigger game. I was already reading Anaïs Nin and Henry Miller. In other words, I was determined to lose my virginity as soon as possible and have many lovers. I hated our New Haven suburb and my high school for its devotion to conformity. As far as I could tell, the most creative endeavor for the girls was growing their hair as long as possible in order to qualify for the National Long and Silky contest. All I wanted to do was get out and stay out. I spent my time dreaming of escape to New York, specifically Greenwich Village, where I hoped to find like-minded people, poets, and writers. I moved there for college and stayed for graduate school. Though I didn't become a fixture at Studio 54 or Warhol's factory, I'd made a life there, worked in publishing, eventually married, and had a daughter. Then something happened. After 20 years of living and working in New York, my husband was offered a job at Yale University Press. You didn't need a Google map to see where this was going. New Haven, my childhood home and the crucible of my pain. I was supportive when he accepted the job. The reality of moving home took a little longer to fathom. For me, the biggest challenge was having my mother become a regular part of our lives. When I lived in New York, we spoke once a week, perfunctorily on Sundays. Now I would be living 5.1 miles away from her. I told myself I could handle it. After all, I was well into my 40s when we moved home. I was a mother in my own right, yet my conflicts with my mother still flared brightly. Why was everything so loaded? Why was I reduced to my teenage self almost every time we got together? Was everything she said a criticism, or did it only sound that way? We circled each other like wary boxers. Once, she asked why I bought low-fat cottage cheese instead of fat-free, and nearly set off a world war between us. It was cottage cheese, for God's sake. Translated through the mother-daughter lexicon, was I ever going to be good enough? When my mother was recovering from some surgery in January of 2013, I stayed with her to help out. We had been living in New Haven for more than a decade by then, my dad gone, my daughter a teenager in her own right. We had made new friends and were knitted in. I had become a partner in a literary agency and was commuting to New York twice a week, getting my city fix. On top of that, God shined down his light on our fair city and conferred an Apple store upon us. Did I really have any reason to complain? I wasn't exactly looking forward to staying with my mother, but I also knew the job would be made less onerous by the fact that she, even at 83, was more comfortable refusing help than demanding it. Best summed up in the well-known joke, "How many Jewish grandmothers does it take to screw in a light bulb?" "You shouldn't worry. I'll sit in the dark." Every day, one of her bridge ladies visited, as if in an unspoken rotation. They were smaller now, some a little unsteady, but still decked out in color-coordinated outfits, accessories, heels, and bags. When they said I looked good, I wondered if they really thought I was fat, if my unruly hair was an offense. When they asked after my husband and daughter, it struck me that they had been there for all of the rites of passage in my life.